You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
It's up for grabs now! Thomas! Right at the end!
Aguero! I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again! So watch it! Drink it in!
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Final Countdown, a podcast looking back at great finals within the game of football. I'm Lewis here, my co-host Adam.
Hello there.
And I want to get straight into the report today because arguably...
No messing.
I think this is the most important season of this decade.
Ooh, yeah. Hang on a minute.
I'm throwing it out there.
He's gone out there.
Even, and I would also
What do you mean by important?
Well, we're going to get into it, but a good headline. Actually, I will skip ahead to this because it's a really good headline. So one of them that got used in relation to this season is that this was known as the night football was reborn.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, very epic in its scope. So,
I mean, yeah, this is our first... last game of the season decider.
Where it actually mattered. And there's obviously reasons for how that came about, which are pretty tragic, but we'll talk about that. But for those that haven't bothered to look at the title of the podcast, this is the 1988 to 1989 English First Division, so how the season wrapped up and a bit of an overview of the season as a whole. So, as I said, this is arguably the greatest and the most dramatic end to a domestic season ever, probably challenged only really by the Aguero moment. Mm. I think these have to be one and two, whichever order you put them in.
Yeah,
I don't think anything comes close.
Can't think of anything else that ended... on the last day, other than Graham Stewart's double to rescue Everton in 96. Everton.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which, you know, it's a valid argument, but it's not quite the Sheen avoiding relegation compared to winning the title. But
yeah, fair enough.
But nevertheless, so for those that don't know what we're talking about, if you have a vague interest in football, I'm sure you've come across this. So Arsenal and Liverpool were the two teams running a two-horse race for the title as we get in towards the final weeks of the season. They were scheduled after a two-week delay to the season, which we'll talk about in a moment, to play one another on the final day. So originally it wasn't supposed to be the final day. It was one of the fixtures that got rearranged following the Hillsborough disaster.
So when you say final day, was there other games going on or was this the only
one?
Good
question.
Because in my head, this was the only game happening.
I think that might be correct. Let me check.
Sometime later.
Yeah, you're completely right, Ad. It was the only game of that day. So it really was the main event in all caps, really. So they were facing each other. Arsenal needed to beat Liverpool by a minimum of two goals because there was a four-point swing in the goal difference that was needed.
Yep.
Liverpool, obviously, ahead on that. Liverpool were ahead by 3 points
and
ahead on goal difference. And everyone assumed that Liverpool were going to win. They were heading into that final game. They were huge favourites. Liverpool hadn't lost by two or more goals at Anfield in 3 years. Mm. This didn't happen. Liverpool didn't get beaten at Anfield. We certainly didn't get shut out 2-0.
Wow.
Arsenal hadn't won there in 15 games, which is incredible. Furthermore, Liverpool had never previously been defeated when playing forwards John Aldridge and Ian Rush. So Ian Rush is back from Italy at this point.
Oh yeah, of course he is. Yeah.
This is his returning season.
Yeah.
And his dream team partnership really with Aldridge just paid
dividends. Not calling the shots now, are you, Rushy?
No, exactly. Yeah, they are they are sharing it apiece. But reigning league champions Liverpool seemed undeniable. However, the game was due to take place only 41 days after the Hillsborough disaster.
Yeah.
So the briefest of overviews, I'm certain everyone listening to this knows what we're talking about, but there was an FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, played at a neutral ground, which was Hillsborough, Sheffield Wednesday's ground, and due to poor organisation, decision-making, etc., gates were opened...
By the police.
Yeah. And by the stadium manager to allow extra fans to come in. It was poorly done.
It was back in the day without seats.
That's right, yeah. So it was all standing, and in the following chaos that ensued, as... fans started to get crushed. They tried to get onto the pitch in order to obviously free themselves from.
Yeah, it's weird. Obviously, younger listeners, I mean, you might know anyway, but younger listeners might not be familiar with the circumstance. Obviously, the hooligan element
of course,
English football led to cages being placed on the front of stands.
That's right.
So you might watch football now and it's completely alien, but back then they had these big, you know, steel cages on the front of stands. So as people flooded in, it just got rammed and rammed and rammed, yeah. and there was nowhere to go, and that was the problem.
That's right.
It was always a mixture of everything wrong
with English football. And also, something in the research for this that I'd found out that I didn't know previously, Hillsborough had failed a safety check 6 years earlier. I think it had been used sparingly in the time since then, but basically following that report, warning people, because there was accidents where arms and legs were broken from fans being crushed, terrible, but nothing, no actions were taken following that safety report. Yeah. It was still kind of allowed to just do what it was, which is really obviously shocking.
Yeah.
But in the end, a total now of 97 fans, obviously of all ages, lost their lives as a result of Hillsborough. So obviously incredibly tragic, kind of 5-6 weeks before the end of the season.
Yeah.
And everyone was really split. So reaction both from the fans and the players. Some fans and players thought it was the right thing to carry on with the season to try and honour the legacy of the fans.
I was going to say, there's no way it didn't affect Liverpool, isn't it?
Like, no.
They obviously won the cup final, but there was an element because it was Everton, there was a sense of City together.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But this wasn't that.
No, no.
It was the league title against a London club.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Arsenal were really sensitive. So at this final game of the season, a load of fans brought flowers to lay at the ground. There was a formal exchanging of flowers between Arsenal representatives and Liverpool representatives. But like you say, for some that wanted to carry on, there were others that just were completely shocked and thought, hold on, how can we focus on anything as trivial as football?
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, Liverpool would take on Everton in this season, the FA Cup final, days before their Arsenal match. So this was about 5-6 days, I think, beforehand.
Yeah.
They won extra time, 3-2. Do you know the quirk, to drag it back to football, do you know the quirk about the goal scorers in this game? I think we covered it in our
both
report.
Both subs got two.
Correct, yeah. It was the first time it had happened for Everton.
That's right, the Ginger Ninja.
That's right. He came on and he scored two goals, and then it was beaten 2 minutes later by Rushy, just nicking that record as well.
Stuart McCall's never been called the Ginger Ninja.
Before today, we will make it stick. In the 9 days before the rearranged title clash, Arsenal had drawn at home to Wimbledon. So that was basically seen as the nail in the coffin that Arsenal, who had done so well in kind of keeping Liverpool at bay, had kind of stumbled at the last minute. And that's how Liverpool got a 3-point gap and their goal difference went up. So the feeling among the Arsenal players that they had lost the title already. And at the turn of the year, Arsenal's lead over Liverpool had been 15 points.
Wow.
Incredible stuff. So literally, as we went into the new year, Arsenal had...
They kind of choked a little bit.
Massively so. Yeah. So they only won 10 of their last 20 games of the season.
Wow.
So literally, it's like a game of two halves, a season of two halves.
Yeah. And that would have been... Yeah, that's long before Hillsborough happened. That was, April.
Totally.
So yeah, it's... That is a choke. When you talk about like Newcastle being the ultimate choke, that's pretty big. 15 points at the turn of the year.
Yeah, it's a massive,
for that Liverpool team as well.
I know, So Liverpool don't start brilliant, but a little bit like Man City this season, they kind of just get into gear and then they're unstoppable. Yeah. This is a nice little highlight. So the match would be covered by broadcasting dream teams across all mediums. So we'll enjoy these because there's a couple of names that we really enjoy here.
Yeah.
So the game would be shown on ITV's The Match, hosted by...
Elton Wellesby.
He was joined by England manager Bobby Robson. The match commentator was Brian Moore, alongside former Spurs manager David Pleat. And then on the radio, it was described...
David Pleat's come back. Did he drive there?
They're keeping him on radio. Don't put him on camera. Do not put him on camera.
Don't let him slow up on the way in.
We'll collect you from the hotel, Mr. Pleat. This is a door-to-door service.
Driver, can you just slow up? I think I know this girl. David.
Moving swiftly on the radio, the action was described by Peter Jones and Alan Green. I forget how long
Green
has been around.
What a commentator.
Yeah, exactly. So I just enjoyed the fact this is like our heyday of nostalgia in terms of the broadcasting teams. The only person missing is really Barry Davies and Moy.
That's the BBC Dream Team, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, Brian Moore, I wasn't a big fan of Brian Moore, actually,
is that right?
But this one is quite iconic, isn't it?
Yeah,
the whole it's up for grabs now. And
yeah, we're going to be giving that its
full
juice.
I'm sure you will, yeah.
Getting into the game, Arsenal would surprise Liverpool and the public by adopting a 5-4-1 formation, which they hadn't used all season. So David O'Leary would play as sweeper, which allowed Lee Dixon and Winterburn, the two kind of fullbacks, to push forward and therefore, in an ideal world, subdue Liverpool's wingers, so the likes of Barnes, to kind of force them to defend a little bit.
Yeah.
So it was a tactical change that worked really well. So getting into this game, as we kind of look at the final day of the season, the first half relatively uneventful, which suited the emotionally strained Liverpool perfectly. So the onus was on Arsenal to win. They had to win by two clear goals at least. But Liverpool could afford to buy their time. So not much really takes place in the first half. No. Which again, Arsenal have 45 minutes now to stop an unstoppable Liverpool team. Oh wow,
I didn't know it was 0-0 at half-time.
Yeah, it's crazy. But
All to do.
But only 8 minutes into the second half, Nigel Winterburn launches an indirect free kick into the box that Alan Smith, who had finished top goal scorer this season with 22 goals, he flicks it on to make it 1-0 to Arsenal.
He's made a darting little run in there. And Smith! And Arsenal have scored. The Liverpool players are surrounding the referee, asking him to speak to a linesman.
The linesman never hesitated at all, Brian. I looked immediately towards the linesman.
Well, let's see here. Winterburn's kick and glanced in by Smith.
Liverpool's players would be would protest, claiming that Smith hadn't made contact with the goal, so it shouldn't have stood because it was an indirect free kick.
So I was just going to make a joke about the fact of whether he actually headed it, because it's very minimal contact.
It is very minimal contact, but TV replays would show that he does make enough of it. But it's funny because speaking to the referee David Hutchinson after the game, they asked him, you know, what the Liverpool players, you know, saying to you and what were their protests, and he said he couldn't get a clear answer out of any of them. They all just started protesting about different things. Some people were protesting about a push, some people were protesting that he didn't hit the ball, some people were protesting that the free kick had been too far. Like,
no,
Liverpool
way.
Just clearly were trying to protest, but there wasn't a consensus, which I thought was quite funny. But with the adrenaline flowing now, the game comes to life and Arsenal manager George Graham goes to 4-4-2 to now try and attack, create more chances and try and take the game by the scruff of the neck. So it's Barnes and Aldridge that then counter Arsenal's attack. They put the ball in the back of the net before it's ruled for offside. It was correctly ruled out for offside, to be fair.
Yeah.
But Barnes, who'd been quite quiet all game, manages to slot Aldridge through, but it doesn't count. And with the final minutes on the board, Liverpool tried to time waste and they start to slow the game down with only a minute to go. It's John Barnes, who is idly running through the centre of the pitch, who's dispossessed by Richardson. So Barnes, instead of running to the corner, he's kind of just ambling through midfield.
Just trying to do a Brazil.
Pretty much. And he seems quite relaxed. He doesn't seem like he's concentrating almost, because there's, you know, less than a minute left. What
maybe he's doing the Anfield rap in his head.
You've got to hold and give at the right time.
Oh, shit.
Oh, no. I haven't hold. I have give. I have give. Oh, dear. So as Richardson wins the ball back, he passes the ball back to goalkeeper John Lukic, and everyone is screaming for Lukic to just smash the ball up the other end of the pitch, give Arsenal their last attack. But Lukic decides to roll the ball out to Dixon, who, when he talks about this game, is hilarious, because he's like, I didn't want the ball. I wasn't expecting it. And all of a sudden, Lukic just rolled it to me. I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing? But he goes to kick it just upfield aimlessly, and he sees Alan Smith with a little bit of space. So he thinks, at the very least, I'll hit it to our player rather than just aimlessly kick it up there. And it's Smith who flicks the ball on to Michael Thomas charging through the midfield. So Thomas evades a challenge by Steve Nicol, races into the penalty area and slips the ball past the advancing Grobbelaar to score Arsenal's second, giving way to this tremendous bit of commentary.
A good ball by Dixon, finding Smith. But Thomas charging through the midfield. Thomas, it's up for grabs now. Thomas, right at the end. An unbelievable climax to the league season. Well into injury time, the Liverpool players are down absolutely abject. Aldridge is down, Barnes is down, Dalglish just stands there. Nichols on his knees, McMahon's on his knees. Suddenly it was Michael Thomas bursting through. The bounce fell his way. He flips it wide of Grobbelaar.
And with literally the last seconds of the game played out, Arsenal were then crowned champions of England for the first time in 18 years.
I was going to say, because it was almost literally the last kick of the game, wasn't it? Didn't they just kick off and then that was it?
Yeah.
It was so late.
Exactly. It was absolutely sensational. Again, the only thing later is Aguero's goal. Well, actually, it's pretty much similar.
Pretty much
again,
the same.
Aguero, you kick off and then it's the end.
Yeah.
It is absolutely astounding. But if you will allow me just to read a fairly big excerpt, but I think this sums up in the wake of Hillsborough and everything else. This is from Jason Cowley in his book, The Last Game, Love, Death and Football. And I just thought, rather than me trying to sum up or as debate, I thought this was just a really good way of encapsulating what this meant. For me, there was something cathartic about the whole evening. After all the grief, rage, anger and suffering that had preceded it, here was a game that brought palpable release for nearly all football fans who watched it, with the obvious exception of those who supported Liverpool, and perhaps even for some of them there was a release too, of the fact of the match having taken place, of the season having been completed rather than abandoned. If the home fans had reacted differently to defeat, if they had rioted or raged or even skulked off in fury at the end of the game, instead of staying on to applaud the Arsenal, no one would now remember that night at Anfield as the point at which the fortunes of English football seemed to turn. The fans did not riot. They stayed on to witness Arsenal being presented with the Championship trophy, to witness a conquering army sinking the flag of victory into the Anfield turf at the worst possible moment for the home team. The Liverpool fans instead applauded. It was as if they understood that we were at the start of something new, that there would be no returning to the ways of old. 6 weeks after Hillsborough, those fans demonstrated that they understood the real meaning of sporting glory. And I just thought, it's just, that's poignant and perfect.
Yeah, like you say, it's obviously we're in the midst of the European ban. I mean, it would soon come to an end. So I imagine it was next season they started to talk about the European ban ending.
That's right. It gets extended. I'll talk about it briefly, but it gets extended for one more year at the end of this season.
Right. So it's coming to an end. And in a way, you're right. This, I mean, that could have gone drastically different.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why that kind of headline of the night football was reborn. We're starting to see now the rise of Arsenal, who would become obviously massive in the 90s. We're starting to see the end of Liverpool's dominance, which had basically been the story for the last 15 years, 20 years. We're starting to see TV, which we'll talk about in a minute, take more of a prominent role. The fan trouble starts to quieten down now. Obviously, there are reforms in terms of standing and seating in stadiums. It really is the change. And even though we're not quite at the Premier League yet, this is basically what allows the foundations for that stuff to happen.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the season as a whole. So the season kicks off, Nottingham Forest, Arsenal and surprisingly Norwich would all start the season really well, competing at the top of the table until Christmas. And this is before Arsenal took charge, with Forest and Norwich desperately trying to chase them down and stay in the hunt. Liverpool, however, would take a while to get into gear. So they would be in eighth position heading into Christmas. Wow. So they were really, really off the boil before then. Their form drop was largely due to the absence of Grobbelaar, who was out of the squad for months with meningitis.
Wow.
I didn't realise.
No, I didn't know.
Adult meningitis, fairly rare.
It was their sub keeper then? It was Liverpool's sub keeper.
Our sub goalkeeper was Mike Hooper. That's Mike Hooper, an English goalie. Probably was never scheduled to play because.
I don't remember him at all.
Well, he's Bristol born, I can tell you that.
Don't remember him. Well, fair play, Mike.
Yeah, fair play, Mike.
Thanks for the memes.
That even though we forgot who you were. But nevertheless, you know,
thanks for making no memories.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine being understudy to Bruce Grobbelaar. It's a pretty thankless job, isn't it?
Yeah.
So perhaps distracted by their run to League Cup glory, because this is the year that Nottingham Forest would win the League Cup.
Oh, yeah.
Which was Cluffy's first silverware and Forest's first silverware in 9 years.
Yeah.
They would beat Luton Town 3-1. But perhaps because they were distracted by that, Forest fall off the pace of the chasing pack, essentially. And,
yeah.
A week later, after Forest's League Cup victory, Hillsborough would happen. And at the end of April, 14 of the 25 Liverpool fans who were extradited in connection with the Heysel disaster were found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. Right. So they went on to serve 1 year in prison, so half of those that were arrested for Liverpool.
Right.
And the ban on English clubs, because of that, was extended one more year.
Okay.
So that's kind of why it
right, okay,
going.
Got it, yeah.
In the lead-up to Hillsborough, Liverpool had finally clicked and seemed unstoppable in their charge to the top of the league. They Arsenal would thrash Norwich, who would go on to finish fourth this season. It's a really good season for Norwich.
Yeah.
They would get thrashed 5-0, and that was effectively the end of their title hopes. So this is when, getting into the business end of the season, Liverpool have caught up, Arsenal have kind of knocked Norwich out of the way, Forest have fallen away because of the cup, and it's just down to these two. And at the end of the season, as we spoke about, Arsenal would obviously lift the trophy only on goals scored, so they didn't even have a positive goal difference.
Wow.
Goal difference was tied, points were tied, it was just the fact that Arsenal had scored more, and when you think about that 5-0 win against Norwich, it seems really, really poignant. It obviously was a bridge too far for Liverpool. And then interestingly, relegated from the first division this season were Newcastle, which was a big surprise, Middlesbrough and West Ham. the result of West Ham going down is that John Lyle, the longest serving manager in the Football League.
You mean Jack Tunney?
That's right. He's finally been eliminated from the top rope after 15 years in charge of West Ham. Crazy. So incredible stuff. When you talk about long serving manager, you think of Dario Gradi at Crewe, you think of Sir Alex Ferguson at United. But yeah, John Lyle, 15 years. He'd been with the club for 34 years in total, joining them as apprentice after leaving school in 1955.
Wow.
So he'd been at the club since then.
That must be hard to sack someone like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But with that, let's just finish with some significant others.
They're dropping Tarantula down his shorts, and it's still be super cool.
So I spoke about, obviously, TV changing things. So one of the biggest changes in the history of football, really, began that ITV had gained exclusive rights to show the Football League matches, both in live and highlight forms. The rights at that time cost $11 million, which was up from $5 million in 1983. So 5 years later, they had more than doubled.
Yeah.
Most of their coverage was of live matches on Sunday afternoons of top flight games. And they would hold the exclusive rights until 1992, when they lost coverage of the newly formed Premier League to Sky.
Yeah.
So that was when everything officially changed. But it ended a long-term partnership with the BBC, who then struck a partnership with the FA for exclusive coverage of the FA Cup, which is still kind of what we've got today.
Yep.
18 million people would watch this this game between Arsenal and Liverpool.
This was live on telly as well.
This was live on telly. Yeah. Absolutely astonishing stuff. I think it's covered in Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch. It's kind of the main thing around there. But Alan Smith, as I mentioned, would be top goal scorer with 22 goals. And then, interestingly enough, Steve Bull, Wolverhampton Wanderers, in the third division, scored 53 goals in all competitions. Wow. Absolutely astonishing.
They went up, I'm assuming.
They go up. But what's interesting is that because the new season hadn't started after he'd got Wolves promotion, when Steve Ball gets called up for England, he isn't technically a second division player, he's technically a third division player, which is
amazing. In a year's time, he goes to the World Cup.
That's right. So he scores against Scotland at the end of the domestic season after making his England debut. Absolutely incredible. But yeah, 53 goals, even at third division, I guess, couldn't be ignored. The playoff format between the second division and the first division is finalised into what it is now in terms of one less relegation spot and then fourth.
They got rid of that relegation playoff
thing. They got the playoff thing. So now it's just the four sides just missing out on promotion would play against each other in the mini tournament.
Yeah.
A random fact here, but Uruguayan Dani Bergara, don't know if that name means anything to you. Apparently he was a really good player. I didn't recognise him, but he became the first foreign manager to lead an English club out at Wembley when he took fourth division Stockport County to the 92 Auto Glass Trophy final. Just a little tidbit of information there. But let's talk about a couple of interesting things to finish with. Transfers and debuts and an in memoriam as well. So Spurs would complete a British transfer record, £2 million for a 21-year-old midfielder.
Paul Gascoigne.
Everton would strengthen their midfield with indie DJ wannabe Pat Nevin.
Pat Nevin.
Just less than $1 million. Mark Hughes would return to Man United following 2 years, one in Barcelona, one in Bayern Munich.
Oh, wow. Forgot that. Yeah.
Hadn't gone particularly well. Yeah. He would return at the end of the season. Everton would sign Tony Cotty, an underrated striker. I think both of us fans of Tony Cotty. Rushy would come back home, obviously, at the start of the season, like we spoke about. At the end of the season, Spurs would sell Chris Waddle to Olympique Marseille in a $4.25 million deal. So the money's starting to go up now. $4 million back then was a lot of money. Yeah. Lineker would end his 3-year spell at Barcelona to join Tottenham.
He joined Tottenham same time as Gazza. I didn't realise that. Okay.
Yeah. So they come into the squad. Actually, I think there might have been a season, as in I think Lineker joins at the end of the season.
Right.
Mark Robbins, an 18-year-old striker, makes his debut for United. So it's not long before he does Sir Alex a favour.
Repays the
faith shown in him. A 19-year-old Welsh midfielder, Gary Speed, makes his debut for Leeds.
Wow.
And then I thought this was bizarre, because it still seems relatively young, but Andy Gray, at the end of this season, 33 years old, played a season at Rangers, would retire.
Right, isn't it, for back then, 33?
Yeah, I guess so, but it just seems like, for the type of player he was, not like he was reliant on pace.
No, he's quite physical, though.
Yeah, exactly.
He batted his legs up or something.
Yeah, he probably was playing with many, many injuries, but
Richard Keys probably gave him a dead leg, a bit of banter.
Look, Andy, it was just banter.
It was just banter.
Such a tenuous link, but it's good.
Any excuse whatsoever. And then finally, it's a sad end to the season as English football legends Dom Revie and Jackie Milburn would pass away.
Oh, wow.
So kind of another generation really starting to fade. Yeah. Like we've had this year with some of the greats going. So sad way to end our report. But as I said, it's exciting times as we're about to breach into arguably the greatest decade in history.
I love the 90s, but yeah, I love the 90s, yeah.
Who doesn't love the 90s? So join us to find out who is the blur and who is the pulp of English First Division football next week.